Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. A designer of the troop surge in Iraq says we're doing it wrong in Afghanistan and especially in Pakistan. David Kilcullen is my first guest this hour. He was a counterinsurgency advisor to General David Petraeus, helping devise the troop surge strategy that has had some success in Iraq. But he says we're getting Afghanistan and Pakistan all wrong, including the drone attacks that are killing more civilians than terrorists in Pakistan. He's calling for a moratorium on those attacks. He has a brand new book called The Accidental Guerrilla, and maybe you saw his op-ed in the Sunday New York Times. David Kilcullen, thanks very much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Sure. Very happy to be here. Thanks.
First, by way of background, so listeners get a sense of who you are and what you've done, what was your role in designing the Iraq troop surge with David Petraeus?
Well, I was his senior counterinsurgency advisor. So there were a bunch of us who went over there at the start of 2007 and tried to take the president's concept for how to stabilize Iraq, which was basically a speech, and turn that into a detailed, resourced, you know, plan about how to actually get out on the ground and turn things around. My job was to be out on the ground with the Iraqi and American units, civilian and military, that were doing the surge and help them figure out how to operate in that environment.
And for people who haven't followed the tactics and the strategy of the surge all that closely, who just think, well, troop surge, it means we put in tens of thousands more people. What was the strategy? What was the troop surge qualitatively once those additional troops got there?
Yeah, the extra numbers were just a means to an end. And in fact, if we had just put new troops in and done nothing else, I think it probably would have made the situation worse rather than better. The fundamental element was that we actually switched over from trying to kill the bad guys to trying to protect the Iraqi people. We realized that a lot of the violence in Iraq was generated by the fact that people didn't feel safe enough to engage in ordinary political discourse with each other. They felt like they had to pick up a weapon and fight each other. So we went in and basically tried to make it safe enough that we could convince people to start talking instead of killing each other. So that meant getting out on the ground, partnering with Iraqi police and military and civil authorities, but actually getting right out onto the ground with the Iraqi people and living with them side by side and making them feel safe.
And you needed the additional 20,000 or so troops in order to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to do that takes you a lot more troops than your alternate, which is to basically just chase the bad guys and kill them. Takes less troops, but doesn't work. So
what do you think of President Obama's phased withdrawal plan
out of Iraq?
Yes.
Well, I think, you know, in some ways it's a good thing that Iraq has reached a level of political stability where we have a viable Iraqi state that has negotiated the status of forces agreement with us, and it's a sign of progress that, you know, there's been the provincial elections and a lot of the violence has dramatically diminished. I mean, that's the main point of the surge. We reduced violence by about 95% over that 18-month period.
But once you withdraw those troops, well, would you define, let me get at it this way. Would you say the troop surge in Iraq, as you define it, is still taking place?
No, I think that the surge is formally over, but we're now transitioning to an advise and assist model where we're essentially helping the Iraqis to take charge. You know, the plan is for us to be out of Iraqi cities by the end of June and out of Iraq completely by the end of next year. And, you know, to answer your question, I think it's inevitable that we will see a rise in violence as we step back. But the question is that rise in violence going to be sufficient to tear Iraqi society apart, which is what was happening in 2006, or is it going to be something that the Iraqi civil society and the Iraqi government can handle without a large-scale American troop presence? If it's the latter, then I think we'll be okay. If it's the former, then we may need to revisit the plan.
What do you think will really determine it?
Right now, a lot of the violence in Iraq is Kurd on Arab and vice versa. We're also starting to see something of a rise in al-Qaeda-related violence. So it's really a question of, you know, Arab and Kurd political process to do with Mosul, Kirkuk, and the area in the northern part of the country. Some of that has to do with where people live and have authority, but it also has to do with how the oil revenues are divided. So there's a lot of that stuff. And then the other main issue is the sort of sectarian violence that Al-Qaeda generated in 2006, which is the really damaging part of 06, and sort of trying to avoid returning to that cycle of sectarian violence is one of our key things we have to worry about.
David Kilcullen, my guest on WNYC. He was a counterinsurgency advisor to General David Petraeus, helping design the troop surge strategy for Iraq. He's now the author of a book called The Accidental Guerrilla. So, in your opinion, can an Iraq-style troop surge work in Afghanistan?
Well, a couple of things on that. Firstly, a lot of the stuff that we did in Iraq during the surge was actually copied from Afghanistan to start with. I spent a lot of the second half of the year in 2006 out on the ground in Afghanistan with a series of assessment teams figuring out what was working and what was not working. And a lot of the stuff that we did successfully in Iraq actually came originally from Afghanistan. So there's no reason on the face of it that we shouldn't be able to do a similar thing back in Afghanistan, which is where a lot of these ideas came from. The difference is going to be it's a very different society. And so the principles may be similar, but I think the activities and how it's going to actually look on the ground will probably be quite different.
Give me an example.
Well, Iraqi tribes are very ordered and hierarchical, and you can make a deal with the tribal sheikh, and the sheikh can make that deal stick. So a lot of what we did in Al Anbar and areas around Baghdad was based on making deals with civil society through the tribes. In Afghanistan, it's quite different. The tribes aren't structured in the same way, so it's kind of a first among equals situation, and you really can't make deals in the same way. But also, the tribal structure in Afghanistan is extremely heavily eroded by basically 30 years of violence. And so I think in Afghanistan, we're going to see more district-based civil society, sort of community partnerships. I think that's probably the main difference socially.
The main point of your op-ed yesterday was that the drone attacks by the U.S. into Pakistan from Afghanistan are doing more harm than good. Why would they be doing more harm if they're killing Al-Qaeda or Taliban leaders?
Well, they're definitely killing Al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders, and that's a good thing. But they are also leading to a rise in militancy in the Punjab, which is the eastern half of the country where most Pakistanis live. And we've seen about 120 major terrorist attacks in that part of Pakistan in the last 2 years. We've also seen a very substantial rise in sectarian violence and other forms of militancy in the main inhabited, you know, settled parts of Pakistan, including the Northwest Frontier Province, but also in the Punjab. And a lot of that is driven by anger and by alienation due to a sort of very heavy kinetic focus, you know, killing the bad guys focus that we've taken in the western part of the country towards Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and that the strikes are part of that.
And you put it in a very interesting way in the op-ed, at least interesting to my eye. You said this is part of a bigger mistake, which is to personalize the war in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Do you want to talk about that notion of personalizing the war?
Well, I think we have tended to treat the war like it's a fight between us and Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, you know, who are the two, number one and number two of Al-Qaeda. But there's a hell of a lot more going on here. And in my book, I talk about the syndrome that I call the accidental guerrilla, where basically an extremist group like Al-Qaeda will set up shop in some remote area. We will then go in there to deal with that very small terrorist group, but we end up alienating and causing a backlash from the bulk of the population in that area, and we basically end up fighting everybody. So I use the analogy that imagine that burglars come into your neighborhood and they set up a safe haven in some house, and then they go and start robbing the rich people on the other side of town. If the police come to your neighborhood and they start blowing up people's houses because there's terrorists somewhere in your neighborhood, sooner or later everyone's going to turn against the police and push them out. Instead of that, if the police come in quietly and they start doing investigations and figuring out who's the bad guys, who's the good guys, then there's a much greater chance that they're going to get the burglars without causing a big backlash. But the thing is, it's worse than that, because it's not like you know, say Washington, D.C. or New York police coming into a district in New York. It's like the Iraqi police coming into a district in New York or the Afghan police coming in, because it's people from the other side of the world who don't understand the environment. So where I come down in the end in the book is to say, look, we need to get out of the business of intervening with large-scale military force in other people's countries because of small-scale terrorist groups. Instead, we need to be working with local partners and getting them to help us deal with these small-scale groups that exist in these environments.
Listeners, we can take some phone calls or questions on the web for David Kilcullen, a rare opportunity for you to ask a question of someone who was actually a designer of the troop surge in Iraq, who is now out there commenting about the war in Afghanistan and Pakistan and saying there should be a moratorium on the drone attacks, among many other things that he writes about in his book, The Accidental Guerrilla. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433. If you want to talk to David Kilcullen right now, 212-433-9692, or post a comment or a question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And to further what you just said, one of your main points in the book is that local leaders don't fail to go after the extremists because they don't care about them, but rather because they're intimidated by them.
Right.
And that's a crucial concept, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a lot of examples in various places around the world where we basically say, well, there's this population that's being manipulated or intimidated by terrorists. We are going to put so much pressure on that population by bombing them that it's going to make them reject the terrorists and push them out. Now, I'm afraid that that's just not how it works, and we have not had any success around the world with that approach. And if you think back to the Blitz in London in the Second World War, all that German bombing did was solidify support for Churchill and make people more determined to beat the Nazis. If you look at what our strategic bombing did to the Nazis in 1944, 1945, essentially all it did was, help the Nazis maintain support until the middle of 1945. German industrial production actually increased under Allied strategic bombing. In Kosovo more recently, you know, we did a similar thing. There's not a lot of evidence to suggest that the fall of Milosevic had to do with NATO bombing. In fact, arguably, you know, that was not a factor. So I think we see this sort of tendency to go in and bomb people, hoping that that's going to make them reject local bad guys. In practice, what you have to do is what we did in Anbar and what we've done in parts of Afghanistan. You've got to go in and make partnerships with people and work with them to push them out. And that involves making people feel safe, not making them feel threatened.
So do you think that U.S. strategists don't get that? Does General Petraeus himself not get that?
General Petraeus definitely gets that. Most of the U.S. strategists that I have worked with get that. This is a more complicated situation in Pakistan because it's not actually our war. This is fundamentally a clash between the Pakistani government and extremism and militancy within Pakistan. And I have to say, at times in the past, elements of the Pakistani military and Pakistani intelligence service have played a double game. So we have a lot of support within Pakistan. Pakistan is not the enemy, but there are elements in the Pakistani national security establishment that have tried to sort of hide behind these drone strikes and say, look, it's not us, we're not hurting you, it's just the bad Americans. And continuing the drone strikes kind of plays into that. We've allowed some of these elements to shirk their own responsibility, which is to get in there and deal with terrorists and militancy on their own territory rather than calling us in to do their dirty work for them.
You know, I wonder if you think different guerrilla situations, guerrilla wars are different with respect to these ideas that you're laying out. Because for a lot of people in the world today, the biggest news story, though it's seen as remote and irrelevant by most Americans, possibly the biggest story in world news right now is that Sri Lanka has declared that it has crushed the Tamil Tiger rebels. And most of the listeners have probably heard over the years about the Tamil Tiger rebels and don't know who they are. But they say that they crushed them by killing their chief and ending his personal three-decade quest for an independent homeland for minority Tamils. They say, I'm reading an AP story now from just a little bit ago, it says that his death has been seen as crucial to bringing closure to the war-racked Indian Ocean island nation. If he had escaped, he could have used his large international smuggling network and the support of Tamil expatriates to spark a new round of guerrilla warfare here. Mm-hmm. His death in battle could still turn him into a martyr for other Tamil separatists, though, it says. Mm-hmm. But is that an exception, or are there different kinds of cases? Because there it sounds like killing the bad guy ended the war.
Well, there's a lot more to it than what's in that AP story. There's been 2 years of ground combat with the Sri Lankan army closing down what was essentially the whole Jaffna Peninsula, which used to be controlled by the Tamil Tigers, down to an extremely small remnant, tiny little area that was left. So they went in on the ground in strength, working with the population, pushing back the guerrillas, and managed to constrict their area till it was tiny. Then at the last stage, they were able to kill the leadership. They didn't just go in and just kill one guy, leaving the rest of the structure untouched, which is what these strikes tend to be doing. The other point is it does differ between different guerrilla groups. So some groups are hierarchical and sort of they have one boss and he tells everybody else what to do. That is not how Al-Qaeda operates, and it's not how the Iraqi insurgents operated. And if you deal with a pyramidal or, you know, a very hierarchical group, then what we call in the business a decapitation strategy of dealing with the leadership can sometimes work. But when you're dealing with a cell-based structure, which is what we have here, you really need to be working to make the environment impossible for those cells to operate in. And that's a much different proposition from going in and just killing the leadership.
Let's take a phone call. And here is Hussein in Brooklyn, originally from Pakistan. Hussein, thanks for calling.
Mr. Brian, how are you, sir?
Okay, Hussein, go ahead. What's your question for David Kilcullen?
You know me.
I know
yes,
you.
I am your great admirer. You have encyclopedic knowledge.
You're very kind to me, Hussein.
From cooking to sports. So my question to your knowledgeable friend is that in post-World War II, 125 million human beings, they were butchered between the rivalry between Russia and America. And now, yesterday, the one minister of Pakistan, he said probably 2.5 million human beings, they are again butchered. So when this genocide will end? Because if America patronized one side and the other side patronized the other side, human beings will be lost.
You're talking about U.S. support for India, Hussein?
No, sir. I never said that. I said that U.S. support one segment of Afghan society.
Of Afghan society.
And then there is another segment of society who has a difference with the local people, local leadership. So if America patronized one segment of society, they always have an upper hand.
Right. And that is an important question, David Kilcullen, isn't it? Because if the U.S. is seen as supporting whoever President Karzai is seen as representing, to some degree other portions of the Afghan population feel disenfranchised, and that's a delicate line to walk.
Yeah, I think that one of the motivations for the Taliban in Afghanistan has been the belief that they're not being represented, the people in the local level are not being represented effectively in the Afghan local government structure. After 2002, after the Bonn Agreement, we actually promised to hold local district elections. Those were never held. And one of the things the Taliban has done is it has come in and said to tribes at the local level, hey, look, this guy that's been appointed from Kabul to be your local governor, he's unrepresentative. We're going to work with you to get you back in the game and to regain control of your district. I think one of the most important things we could do in Afghanistan in the next year or two would be to actually hold those district elections and have representative government and fix some of the governance problems at the local level. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to the fact that people who feel like the government doesn't have their interests at heart are a lot more likely to rebel. And I think that is certainly one of the problems we've experienced in Afghanistan.
Rashmi on Long Island. You're at WNYC. Good morning, Rashmi.
Hi, how are you? I absolutely, totally agree with the general. I think it's the first sensible thing I have heard in a long time. The basic premise has to be that you cannot win war in Afghanistan. Nobody has ever done it. and Britishers left and everyone left. So you cannot go and say you'll bomb people and get it. I think General is absolutely right. All other things, working with the government, this and that, has to build upon the fact that basically you cannot fight, kill people, and win their support. And I absolutely wholeheartedly agree with him.
Rush, thank you. David Kilcullen, before you go, I'm just curious about a couple of terms from your book. You use the phrase armed propaganda. Sounds like words with weapons. What does it mean?
Armed propaganda is a technical term in counterinsurgency. It is essentially sending a message by killing people or taking armed action against them. And we see the Taliban doing this all the time, both in Afghanistan and Pakistan. You've probably seen some of the horrendous images of what the Pakistan Taliban have done to the local people in various parts of Pakistan. That is not only intended to kill that person, it's also intended to send a message to everybody else. And, you know, it's kind of a godfather-like approach to terrifying other people by sending a message through violence. That's typical of the Taliban. It's also very typical of Al-Qaeda.
And in terms of defining the enemy, people say all kinds of things. They say Wahhabism, they say Islamofascism, whatever. You use the terms Takfiri terrorism and Neo-Salafi jihadists. Takfiri is a word most people haven't heard. What is that?
Takfirism is the belief in Islam that somebody else who disagrees with you can be declared an infidel or not a real Muslim, and you can then kill them. Takfirism is a heresy within Islam, and it basically defines Al-Qaeda's worldview. Al-Qaeda are the ultimate Takfiris. The reason I say it's a heresy, it's not me saying that. In 2005, unprecedentedly, 500 ulama or Islamic scholars got together in Jordan under the sponsorship of King Abdullah, and after several weeks of debate and discussion, unanimously declared Al-Qaeda to be heretical and its terrorist ideology to be unacceptable to all the different sects within Islam. Now, they've never got 500 ulama together before, let alone get them in a room and get them to agree on something. So I think this is a very important ideological development, which basically says that the Muslim world has taken a good hard look at Al-Qaeda's ideology. They've thought about it, they've talked about it, and they've decided that it is unacceptable. And I think that's a really important step forward, which unfortunately didn't get a lot of attention in the West. It turns out that after 8 years of terrorism, most people in the Muslim world have essentially rejected the Al-Qaeda worldview. So I think that's an important thing, because it means that if we don't do anything more egregiously crazy, like, you know, invading major countries because there's a few terrorists in there, that over time, the Al-Qaeda ideology is so unappealing to the majority of people that it's likely to collapse. And we can contain it, work with local populations, make local partners, and deal with it. Let me just finish with an anecdote. You know, on the 7th of December 2001, the last Taliban stronghold in Afghanistan fell. It was the city of Kandahar. On that day, there were only 110 CIA officers and about 300 U.S. special forces working in Afghanistan. But we had 50,000 Afghans fighting on our side against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. That's how we took Afghanistan in 2001. It was nothing to do with high-tech air power. It was the fact that the majority of people were tired of what was happening there and worked with us to push the bad guys out. Right. When you can get a situation like that, then you can win. And that's also exactly what happened in Anbar.
And, you know, even as we've been speaking this morning, a few stories breaking around us, this just from just out from the UN, their refugee agency, says fighting in Pakistan between the military and the Taliban militants has now displaced more than 1.4 million people just since May 2nd. So that's about a million and a half new refugees in Pakistan just this month. Also, I don't know if you heard about the assassination attempt on President Karzai's brother this morning. He was not harmed, though apparently a bodyguard was killed. So that's, you know, that incident from Afghanistan. Any reaction to the million and a half refugees this month in Pakistan and the implications?
Well, there's another side story to that, which is that some charities associated with Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is a terrorist organization, have actually moved into those parts of the country and are now delivering charity assistance to the displaced population. One of the things that we found through hard experience in Afghanistan and Iraq is when you go into these environments, it looks like a military problem and the military is essential, but if all you bring is military capability, you actually make the problem worse. Now, the Pakistani army went into SWAT with very little consideration of the plight of civilian displaced persons, as we call them. There's a thing called the Emergency Management Office, EMO, within the Pakistani government, which was established to deal with the Muzaffarabad earthquake back a few years ago. Those guys are in there and they're doing a great job, but they can't do everything by themselves. And when you move into an area like that, the population flee in large numbers. And if you don't have ready to go a series of humanitarian and longer-term assistance measures for that population, all you end up doing is creating refugee camps, which then become prey to the insurgents recruiting people from them. So, you know, I think a long way to go yet in the SWAT campaign, which we've been watching. But what I'd really like to see is a little bit more thought for the humanitarian welfare of the population, not necessarily just because that's the right thing to do, although it is, but also because ultimately that kind of thing makes these sorts of operations go a lot better in the long term.
David Kilcullen, he designed the troop surge in Iraq along with General David Petraeus and others, and he is calling for a moratorium on the drone attacks by the United States into Pakistan, and he is the author of the brand new book, The Accidental Guerrilla, Fighting Small Wars in the Midst of a Big One. Thank you so much. I hope we can call on you again as developments
warrant. Hey, yeah, thank you. Good talking to you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. When we come back in a minute, we're going to talk some New Jersey politics with one of the candidates for governor and listen to some of what's going on in New Jersey today. While the recession has forced the closing of the motor vehicles office, don't go for your driver's license renewal today in New Jersey. Dozens of casino inspectors have been declared essential state employees and they're exempt from the furloughs. So stay tuned.